Okay, those who didn't, hands up. Those who did, hands up. Oh, good. All right, don't be shy. Good. So no homework for today. In that case. All right. Questions about what I told you yesterday? No. It's even easier. Okay, so in that case, today I would like to talk about something completely different. So as I told you yesterday, I believe that there are three main pillars on which quantum mechanics stands, at least three that I know, and they are necessary in order for us to understand quantum mechanics. And they are entanglement, or which is kinematic non-locality, because that is non-locality that only has to do with the fact that the state of the, yeah, that we are talking about the Hilbert space, which describes the state of a quantum system. Then we have non-locality of the equations of motion. And I described the small instance of the Aharonov-Bohm effect and the whole issues that are surrounding it. And we saw that even the simplest quantum interference example, like the two-slit experiment, is described by non-local equations of motion. And without thinking of the non-locality of the equations of motion, we cannot really have any hope to understand what is happening in the two-slit experiment. And today I will talk about the third issue, which is that of pre and post-selection, or in more general terms, is concerned with a different view about the time flow in quantum mechanics. So, what is the whole issue? Think first of classical mechanics. Classical mechanics is quite simple. So if you know you have a classical particle, and you know its position, and its velocity at some moment, t0, and suppose that you would know the dynamics. In that case, you know everything about it. You know essentially the world line, you know where the particle will be in the future, you know where the particle was in the past, you know everything. So no measurement that you will do in the future will tell you any new information, because you can already calculate from what you know today what will happen with a particle in 2 days. And the same way, you don't need anybody to tell you where was the particle yesterday, because you can just find out. But quantum mechanics is different. So suppose that I start at t0, my quantum system in some state psi. And then this state evolves. And suppose I know the whole dynamics, so then I know how the quantum state evolves. And at a later time, I make a measurement. I make measurement, say, of an operator B, which has different eigenstates, B1, B2, Bn. Well, in general, I don't know what will be the result. Okay? All I can say is what is the probability to obtain the eigenvalue B1, or the eigenvalue B2, or the eigenvalue Bn. But in general, I'm not able to tell which of them will appear. So that means that the moment I perform a measurement, I get new information about the system. Okay? This is probably the most important thing in quantum mechanics. That although I know perfectly well what was the past, I have complete information about the dynamics, a new measurement delivers new information. And now I'm going to use this information. And I'm going to use this information not in the way in which people think in general. Suppose that what happened is that I obtained the eigenvalue B1. Then the usual image is that the state propagated from here up to there,
Then a measurement occurs, the state collapses on B1, and it continues on B1. Oh. By the way, I say the state collapses, again, please remember, I'm not into trying to interpret what happens at the measurement. For all practical purposes, the state collapses, and I will use this very simple language. Whatever interpretation you want to give will just come back to the same thing. So I'm not interested in that. I'm interested in something completely different. I'm not interested in what happens from here on. I'm just interested in this region, because between T initial and T final. So my experiment would be like that. This particular particle started in the state psi, underwent some evolution. Perhaps there were some measurements here. There were all kinds of things. And then I measured an operator B, and I obtained the answer B1. By now, for the whole time, both these things, both these pieces of information are relevant. If I ask what happened with the particle here, this information and that information will both play a role. Okay? Let me give you a simple example. So suppose that I start the system in the state psi. At a later time, I measure the operator B, and I find the eigenstate B1, which let me just call it phi. Let me just call it phi for symmetry. And that at some intermediate time, I measure an operator A. An operator A which has eigenstates A1 up to An. And what I would like to know is the following. What is the probability that A gave the value AK, given the fact that the system started in the state psi, and given the fact that at the end of the day, I performed a measurement, and I found the system in the state phi. So again, be careful. The state phi is not what happens with a state psi which underwent the evolution. Here I perform a measurement which is totally independent of what happened before, and I just select one of the possible outcomes. This is the eigenstate B1. And I would like to know what is this probability. Okay? Well, how do I find it? Well, the ordinary way, you take the state psi and you evolve it up to this point. So I start with the state psi, and I evolve it u from time t0 up to that intermediate time t. And there I project on ak. Bless you. And this is the probability that I start with a state psi, and when I measure the operator A, I find the eigenstate AK. From now on, the state becomes AK, and it continues to propagate. So now I have the state AK. I propagate from the time t to t final, and there I project on the state phi, and I take the expectation. Now, this at the moment is the probability, is the joint probability that starting with psi, I get AK, and then I get phi at the subsequent measurement. I'm not interested in that. I'm interested in the conditional probability of getting AK, given the fact that I end up with phi. So for that, I have to normalize this by all ways in which I can get the state phi there. So this is sum over j phi u t final t aj
aj u t 0. So it could have been the case. What are all the possibilities? That I start with psi, I obtain aj, I end up with phi. I obtain a1 or a2 or a3, and in all cases I end up with phi. That's why I not want to start. So this is a trivial formula of conditional probabilities. And it's a simple exercise for a student. But if I look at this formula, I see a couple of things. First of all, I see that for the probabilities of an event here in the middle, both the initial state, psi, and the final state, phi, play an identical role. That's one thing. The other thing is, let me see how should I actually do the computation. This is the naive way in which I did. I take the state psi, I evolved it up to here, then I perform the collapse on the particular output that I was interested in, and I continue to propagate the state. Now, suppose I'm interested just in one particular value, for example, A7. Even if I'm interested in that, in order to compute this normalization, I have to propagate the state psi, take the scalar product with aj, but then propagate every single intermediate state up to the final moment. So although I'm interested in just one particular value, I have to take here and propagate all possible eigenstates of the measured operator till the finite. And that is a hell of a work. Okay? But I can be more clever than that. I can say, look, the same mathematical formula, I can compute it in a different way. I propagate the state psi via u, and I project it on aj. And here, I just take the final state phi, and I propagate it. I apply the operator u not to aj, but to phi. And I propagate it to the intermediate time. So by now, I have to do only two time propagations to propagate the state psi to forward in time, to propagate the state phi backward in time. Then I have to do the scalar products, which I have to do in any case. So it is far more economic to think of this situation in which I start with the state psi, in which I perform the measurement here, and as a result of the measurement, I obtain the state phi. It is far more interesting to think at these two states propagating one of them forward, the other one backward. So this is pure quantum mechanics. I'm not going to change any of the results of quantum mechanics. I'm only going to look at quantum mechanics in a different way. And if I do this, I get a bonus. And the bonus is that it's far easier to compute this formula. In fact, it's even better than that. Perhaps somebody comes and tells me, look, I'm not interested here in measuring A. I'm interested here in measuring some other observable, C. Well, so much better. I still use these two propagations. But instead of eigenstates of A, I will put eigenstates of C. So I have to make only minimal changes in the way in which I compute things. It is far more efficient. Now, generally, when things are far more efficient, there is something underneath. And you really have to take them seriously. The formula suddenly became more elegant. What I can see here is that I have two time boundary conditions. The initial boundary condition and the final boundary condition.
The final boundary condition is totally independent on the initial boundary condition. Because I could have measured here any operator B that I want. So the most important thing, if I come back all the way, is that while classical mechanics had initial conditions, or let me put conditions at one time, I call it initial, you call it final, whichever way you want, there are conditions at one time, quantum mechanics allows you to put two independent boundary conditions for the system. And these two independent boundary conditions play a symmetric role for all the physics that takes place in between. Yes, please.
You have the same phenomenon when you speak about UV evolution.
Very good. Very good. You have the same thing when you speak about classical statistical mechanics. That is, you have the same thing and you don't have the same thing. Let me give you an example. And this is what people do every day. You have some scattering here and you send particles, a flux of particles towards the scattering center, and one particle scatters here, another one scatters there, another one scatters. Okay? Now, you may, here is the preparation, you may want to put a detector, say, here, and look what happened during this experiment only in the case that that detector clicked. So, you make a pre-selection, and you make a post-selection. In fact, this is what people do almost every day in, say, high-energy physics, where you have these big accelerators, but you don't want all the possible events. You want to select only some of the cases. Okay? So apparently, it is the same thing. Well, it is not the same thing. It is emphatically not the same thing. Why? Because suppose that you would actually know the dynamics here. If you know the dynamics here, and in principle, you could refine your knowledge about the initial state. Here you had some statistical lack of knowledge. You didn't know exactly where the particle went and with what speed. But classically, you could in principle know that the particle started here with this velocity, and then knowing the dynamics in the scattering, you know for sure that it comes here. You don't need to put a detector there. Of course, in practice, it may be difficult. You may not have all the knowledge about the dynamics here. You may not have all the knowledge, the absolute precise knowledge of the impact parameter and speed. But conceptually, you could have it. And once you have it, to put another detector here is a redundant. Now, if you go to quantum mechanics, on the other hand, you start with a plane wave that you send it, and you have the scattered wave, and here you put a detector. There is no more information that I, more detailed information that I could put at the beginning. Once I know the initial state, that is a plane wave, there is nothing more I can do without just modifying it. So, here I could know exactly that it came here. Here I have a plane wave, I know the initial state psi, there is nothing more detailed I can have. And once this wave comes, it's scattered, and I have no way from the beginning to know whether it will end up here or it will end up in another detector over there. So putting a detector and seeing that it clicks is novel information that couldn't have been acquired by more detailed things at the beginning. Okay? It was very good that you raised the question because this is an optical illusion. This is for practical purposes similar to that. Conceptual, it's totally different. And we will see what are the consequences of being totally different. But let me, before doing that, let me think in a different way. You know, whenever you do physics, you would like to get the cleanest possible system. So it's much better to do mechanics and knowing precisely where the system starts with than doing statistical mechanics. That means you give away some of the information that you could have acquired. So that's why in quantum mechanics, if we can, we would like to use pure states because they give the best definition, the cleanest ensemble that we have, rather than deal with the estimators. So let me now imagine that what I do is I start with an ensemble of particles, all of them prepared in the same state size. Yeah, with a single particle, you don't do quantum mechanics. You start with an ensemble of particles. And then you let them propagate, and you make measurements here somewhere at these times. This is the standard way in which you do quantum mechanics. And then you ask, what is happening here when I start with the state size? So far, so good. Now you can imagine that somebody did the following. Somebody came and measured this operator B here. Made a measurement of this operator B at a later time. And here he might have got B1, here might have got B7, here B1 again, B4, B3, and so on. That meaning that here the state was B1, here you obtain the state B7, B1, B4, B3. So now what I see that my original ensemble of identically prepared particles splits in a number of pre and post-selected ensembles. That is, this particle and this particle will be part of a more detailed ensemble, the ensemble that is characterized by the state psi and B1. This particle, together with probably some other particles here, will be part of another sub-ensemble, the one characterized by psi and B7, and so on. So it means that our original ensemble splits into a number of sub-ensembles. The physics in each of these sub-ensembles depends on both things. But when you do ordinary quantum mechanics and you do not postulate, you can view that you actually did postulate, and then you choose to forget about the postulation. Okay? So not postulating is as if you did postulate, and then you said, I'm not interested to learn about the results, so I will put all these sub-ensemble, this sub-ensemble, and that, and that, and that, I will all lump them together, and I will lose information. So not post-selecting is losing information which you could have acquired about the system. So it means that the best ensemble, or the cleanest, or the most filtered ensemble that you can have is a pre- and post-selecting ensemble. And if you really want to see interesting physics, you shouldn't just give away information. You should look at these ensembles and try to analyze the physics of pre- and post-selected ensembles. Not post-selecting is losing information that you could have acquired. More important, you cannot decide which particle belongs to which pre- and post-selected thing a priori. You don't know whether this one will end up with B1 or will end up with B7. You really have to wait till that time. And the whole physics here is given by the two boundary conditions. Okay? And what I'm going to see is what are the interesting effects that one can see when one takes seriously the idea of pre and post selection. By the way, taking seriously the idea of pre and post selection doesn't necessarily mean that I'm going to play and propagate states backward and forward in time. The idea of post selection is independent of that. However, what I will find out is that talking with states propagating forward and backward in time is a very useful tool for discussing these ensembles. And that's why probably I will need to take them seriously. So that is the program that I'm going to present you now. You had a question?
Yeah, sorry, I was actually going to ask you to repeat your definition of pre and post selection.
Oh, you have here an ensemble, a million particles. Okay? They are all prepared in the same way. And I need to start with an ensemble if I really want to do quantum mechanics, because the results are statistical. If I make a measurement, I need to repeat to find probabilities. And this is the typical way in which you do. Now, I start with these million particles. I do whatever experiment I want. And after I'm finished, I measure on each particle a final observable B. And I find that on some of those particles I obtain B1, on others I obtain B7, others I obtain B4, and so on. And now I divide my original ensemble into sub-ensembles. The particle which started with psi and ended up with B1, probably I will find, I don't know, 200,000 particles. I put them in one side. The others which started with psi and ended up with B2, say other 50,000, I form other ensembles. So the whole initial ensemble is now split into sub-ensembles. And I will look at the statistics of all the measurements in each sub-ensemble separately. And if I want to recover the ordinary statistics, the one that is done without post-selection, I just put all these ensembles together. Forget the final thing, and that's it. Is that clear? Good. So now let's go and have fun. I hope you remember this horribly long formula.
Question about it.
Yes.
When you measure at B, you are taking the picture that the wave function collapses to B1, B7, B4.
Correct.
So those U's can't be unitary.
Oh, these U's are unitary. That's why I call them U. they describe the free time evolution here and here. They don't describe the measurement. The measurement
phi is the state right before the measurement.
No. Phi is the eigenstate. Okay, this is important.
Well, that's.
I start with psi here. Psi evolves. And just before I make this measurement, the state is u from t0 to t psi. Okay, this is t0, that is t. Just before I made the measurement, this is the state that arrives here. Here I hit it with a measurement of the operator A. Von Neumann postulate, no brainwash. No, just collapse. The state immediately after this becomes, for example, AK. Just after this. Here was psi, here becomes AK.
Okay, I see.
AK propagates, it arrives there as U from T to T final, AK. Here I hit it with a measurement of the operator B, which may give many different answers. But I want to see only when it gave the answer B1, and with it, I call phi the eigenstate corresponding to that. I should call it B1, but then the formula doesn't look symmetric. I just follow in.
No, I misread that. I understand.
Good. No, that is important because otherwise.
But sorry, but if I is the state after the measurement B, what does it mean by vomit back in time?
Who said after the measurement? Okay, after the measurement, yes. Right. But in formula, okay, forget. This is for the time being a mathematical thing. How do you do an ordinary thing? A state psi evolves, you measure here the operator B, you obtain the state B1. What is the probability to get B1? Well, psi U B1 expectation value squared. If this psi propagated there by U. Yeah, this is the ordinary formula. Now, you say B1 is the state after. Okay, fine. Mathematics doesn't tell you anything. This is the mathematics. Okay, that's all I do. Now, that I want to read the mathematics in a different way than usual, it's up to me. What do I call propagating B1 backward in time? Well, I call that the simple mathematical thing of applying the operator U to the bra instead of applying it to the cup. Okay?
So it's more of the mathematical way of saying it is involving that time other than.
Ah, I didn't say that. I say you can think that it's just a mathematical trick. I actually think it's much more than that. I actually think there is a state that propagates backward in time. But that is not important what we think about it. The mathematics simply tells me I can apply the operator U to B1. Okay? So, by the way, that is why this is why this, the whole effects that I'm going to present you today are here to stay. They don't depend on the way in which I interpret things. The mathematics is there, and the mathematics is correct. Now, I may find, and I do find, far more useful to think of states propagating backward in time. And what do I mean by useful? I mean that, you see, although this would be another way of looking at the same physical situations, by the way, these physical situations are new. Nobody thought of them before Aharonov thought of them, and then we developed the whole theory of them. And once you have new situation, you use new tools. And those new tools help you to ask interesting questions about the physics of these systems. You can always go back and use old tools, and the old tools will give you exactly the same results, but in a more cumbersome way. So I just try to leave them in a nice way. Yes?
If you're acting to the left on the B1, yes. Wouldn't you use the actual end of view and sort of press the minus one?
Oh, yeah, but, well, I acted here. So if you want to say what would be the cat that is equivalent to that, then it is B1 used actual. Okay, that's. But I want to use the bra form, and that's why that thing disappeared. All right. So let's now have fun with this. All right. Let's start with a single spin half particle. Spin half particle that starts in the state absent here. And there is no magnetic field. So the Hamiltonian H equals zero. So you have the most boring situation. Spin up Z and stays there. At a later time, this is T zero. At the time T final, I measure sigma X. And suppose I get the value plus one. Okay? What is the probability to get plus one? If I start half, good. Suppose that what I do in the middle is I measure sigma z. So So this is given that I started with sigma n. And I'm already after this time. So I know that I measured sigma x here and I obtain class 1. And now somebody comes and tells me, look, while you didn't look at this, I measured sigma z there. And I guarantee that nothing else happened during this time. What is the probability that he would get plus 1 here?
1.
What happens in this case? Suppose he tells me, no, I didn't measure sigma that, I measured sigma x. Sorry? What is the probability to get plus 1? Not half?
No, it's 1, because you got to go back.
You already think I'm going back. It's good. Other people could have thought, well, if I get minus 1 here, I wouldn't be able to get plus 1 there, so I will not look at that event. But it's much better to think going backwards. The probability is awakened. So now I have an answer one in which I'm absolutely sure that sigma z is plus 1, and I'm absolutely sure that sigma x is plus 1. You cannot have it in an ordinary pre-selected only answer one. There, if you know sigma z, you don't know sigma x. Here, you know both of them. Good. That's quite simple. Let's go back to the same ensemble. Up z sigma x equal plus 1 intermediate times. This is z, that is x. This is a 45-degree direction here. Suppose somebody tells me I measured here the speed in 45-degree direction. What did I get? Well, the speed in 45-degree direction can be written as an operator as sigma x plus sigma z over root 2. Okay? If you want a home exercise, just prove that that is the sigma, the speed in 45-degree direction. Okay? It's pretty easy. So suppose somebody told me that he measured this thing. What result would he get? Well, it's very simple. And I tell you, sigma x I know for sure is 1. So 1. Sigma z I know for sure that is 1. Over root 2. This is the result that you get. Yes. Well, if there are no complaints, then I think. It's not an eigenvalue. Why it's not an eigenvalue?
Plus and minus.
Correct. Not an eigenvalue. What should I have done? Come on, guys. I wrote that horrible formula for you. I start with this. I propagate. The propagation is 0. I have to. So I get plus 1 and minus 1 with some probabilities using that. Did I erase it? Oh, yes, I erased it. I wanted to keep it for you. So I get sometimes plus 1, sometimes minus 1. On the other hand, this is such a nice result. Look, this. I know for sure that sigma x is plus 1. When I measure it, I always get it plus 1. I know for sure that sigma z is plus 1. It must be 1 plus 1 over root 2. You see, one of the good, one of the important lessons is that you should never kill an idea just because it's wrong. Now, look, I make many jokes, but this is not a joke. Sometimes you feel that the idea is good, and if it is wrong, what may happen is that you didn't ask the correct question, okay? The physics tries to tell you something, and you have to see exactly where you went wrong and try to save the result. So this is a very good result. It happens to be wrong, but it is wrong not because the result is wrong, but because the question is not precise enough. So let me try to see what is the problem. Why don't I get square root of 2 here? Okay? Good. Where shall I do it? Okay. Let's see what is happening here. Let me start again with this thing. Fz sigma x equal plus 1.
Is it the measurements sigma x and sigma z don't commute? You can make one of them.
They don't. Good. That's the point. But let me try to make that point a bit more clear. Then I measured either sigma z or sigma x. It was true that sigma z is definitely plus 1 as long as I measured it alone. It is true that sigma x is definitely plus 1 as long as I measure it alone. But let me try to measure them together, because a measurement sigma in 45 degree direction means measuring them together. So let me first measure sigma z and then measure sigma x. What will I get now?
1 and 1.
With certainty. You see now where is this going, yes? What will I get now? Half and half. So now everything can happen. Why is that? You see, the information that is sigma z comes here up to this time of measurement, and indeed it informs this measurement, it should be plus 1. This information comes here, tells me sigma x is plus 1. Here the information that sigma z is plus 1 comes up to this moment, but the measurement of sigma x here disturbs that information. So the later measurement of sigma z is disconnected from this original preparation. The same way, the information that sigma x is plus 1 propagates up to here because the measurement of sigma z disturbs it and the information doesn't get there. Okay? So because I cannot commute these two things in time, I cannot measure them simultaneously. A measurement of the spin in 45 degree direction means to measure simultaneously sigma x and sigma z. And because I cannot commute these two things, I'm stuck. So this is the main reason why I don't get my beautiful result. All right? So by now I know that I'm mistaken, and I know why I'm mistaken. And that is important. Because when I know why I'm mistaken, I know what I'm going to do now. Yeah, take a look.
Okay. Are you interpreting saying that measuring sigma 45 is measuring the
one? No. Before taking the break. No, I'm not interpreting it. If you want to measure an observable, suppose you want to measure an observable A, and you have a measuring device that has a pointer Q. you know what sort of Hamiltonian you have to put between the system and the measuring device in order to measure A? You need a Hamiltonian of interaction. And that Hamiltonian of interaction is some G of T, which is you turn on and off the measuring device. And you put an interaction A times P, where P is the momentum conjugate to Q. Okay. This is what you have to do in order to measure A. Why is that? Suppose the interaction is sudden, so that I can forget the rest of the Hamiltonian during the time of interaction, then the time evolution U is e to the I integral g of t a p dt. And if I arrange that the integral g of t dt should be 1, then this is e to the I a p, which is a shift operator for q with the value of a. Okay? This is the first thing you have to learn when you talk about measurement flow. So, the way in which you couple then that it occurs a collapse or it occurs something else is another story. But this is the Hamiltonian that governs the interaction of your measuring device with a system. And now, if at the same time you would put here a G of T BP, well, I can, it's the same thing as I have A plus B times P. So if I want to measure the operator A plus B, I have to make a simultaneous coupling both to A and to B.
Yeah, but the point is, just because we are summing two operators, it doesn't mean that...
Well, this simply means that at the same time, I have an interaction both with A and with B. That's exactly the meaning.
But they are operators. You're speaking about something else when you say that the value of sigma x
and sigma z are operators that I want to measure here. Okay, let's take a look.